This benefits all of us because if there's more housing, people don't really look at city limit boundaries when they're deciding where to live. They look at what's a good place to live and where it's close to where they work and all those other things. So, you know, we all benefit if there's more housing in our area.
Finding and paying for housing these days is expensive. Take Sacramento, California, where a typical one-bedroom apartment goes for more than $1,500, and transplants from the Bay Area are driving up costs even more. There, nearly 3 in 4 renters are rent-burdened. But the California city is hardly alone. A recent study by the Pew Research Center says the U.S. has a shortage of between 4 million and 7 million homes. But the thing about a crisis is that it can inspire and catalyze change. That's how planners and elected officials are looking at things in Sacramento. They've taken zoning reform actions to accelerate the supply of housing by doing several things, including streamlining permitting, relaxing restrictions around ADUs, and incentivizing affordable housing production. And at the beginning of this year, the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development awarded Sacramento County a $2.7 million federal pro-housing grant, which stands for Pathways to Removing Obstacles to Housing. Today, we're talking to one of the planners leading the charge in Sacramento. Tom Pace is the Director of Community Development for the City of Sacramento. He's our first guest in the 2025 season of People Behind the Plans, an APA podcast. I'm your host, Megan Stromberg, Editor-in-Chief of the American Planning Association. Tom, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
It's great to have you here. One of the things we like to start with on People Behind the Plans is to sort of learn your origin story. Is planning something that you had always wanted to do?
No, I think as a young person, I had not heard of planning. I didn't know what planning was, but I had heard of architects, and I was always fascinated by buildings and the built environment. And when I was in high school, I was researching, you know, what do architects do and what does it take to become an architect? And in the course of doing that research, I realized that maybe I wasn't cut out to be an architect. But I was fascinated reading some books of architecture and about the work of architects. And I found out that over the centuries, many architects had also done something called city planning, which I had not known about before that point, and realized that, oh, that's a thing, that there are people who actually design and plan cities from scratch. At least that was my initial thought of what city planning was. And so drawing a map, you know, and laying out roads in a grid and right. You know, all that fun stuff and figuring out how it all works. So that kind of set me on my path. Right as I was going into college, I decided I wanted to be a city planner.
And now you've done quite a bit of city planning in your career and have worked your way through the ranks in Sacramento. I understand you've been there for a while.
About 30 years, 3 different jurisdictions, mostly with the city of Sacramento, but also with a couple of other communities in the region.
And now, of course, you're the community development director, but you just mentioned the region, and that leads me back to something I said at the beginning. Congratulations to Sacramento County for its tremendous recognition of its zoning efforts and the HUD grant that the county recently received. Do you have a sense of how that will be used and how it will push some of the reforms that have already been started even further?
Yes, I think it'll be a benefit for certainly for our county as a whole and for the region that goes beyond Sacramento County. While I don't work for Sacramento County, I work for the city of Sacramento. I can say that I'm aware that the county received $2.7 million and that their plan is to do some comprehensive corridor planning, modernizing land use planning documents for a number of commercial corridors that have opportunity for mixed use development, looking at infrastructure need and priority phasing analyses in those areas, and establishing financing districts to help build the required infrastructure needed. Also, they'll be looking at an adaptive reuse program and streamlining affordable housing in a number of sub-areas of the county that are called special planning areas. And they'll be completing a round of work that they've already started earlier on what we in California call the housing element, which is part of our comprehensive plan system in California. Each of our comprehensive plans, which is called a general plan, has a housing element, and that relates to a larger planning effort called the regional housing needs allocation. So a lot of technical California jargon there, but they were identified really because HUD has a list of priority geographies in which they use to prioritize applicants, and the county was identified as one of those priority geographies. So you know, this benefits all of us because if there's more housing, people don't really look at city limit boundaries when they're deciding where to live. They look at what's a good place to live and where it's close to where they work and, you know, all those other things. So, you know, we all benefit if there's more housing in our area.
And the county certainly has a peer in the city of Sacramento in exchanging ideas and figuring out that you don't have to reinvent the wheel.
Exactly. Often ideas do pass back and forth between city and county.
I'd like to go back to the beginning of this zoning reform effort for the city of Sacramento. I know you've made a number of significant changes to accelerate the supply of housing and focusing particularly on infill housing in already built up areas. How did this idea of zoning reform get started in Sacramento?
Well, I think there were a number of routes to it. We can certainly talk about the planning routes to it, I think, later on. But in 2009, recession really made necessity the mother of invention. We were facing severe economic conditions, and we realized that we needed to promote economic development. Housing development was part of that, but I think at that moment, we were just thinking broadly. Any and all development would be good because we were desperate, you know, for activity, really, and for development to be happening in our community. And this, coupled with the planned implementation of our new general plan, really led us to imagine, I think, some radical changes to our zoning, at least what seemed radical to us at the time. Nowadays, you know, these ideas are, I think, becoming mainstream. But also, there was a poster child for this as we looked at a specific project in around 2011, I think it was. This was called the La Valentina Apartments. I think this smart growth, affordable apartment project located right next to a light rail station, in other words, exactly the kind of project that we said we wanted to encourage for urban infill, for affordable housing, for transit-oriented development reasons. This project needed something like 19 special permits, variances,
wow,
exceptions, and other approvals under our antiquated zoning and development regulations just to get to the building permit stage. You know, we started with parking reform, and then later on, we moved on to a complete zoning code overhaul.
You said something at the beginning of your answer that I want to point to. It sounds like it started with a plan.
Yes.
So tell us a little bit more about how Sacramento's general plan and maybe your philosophy toward the general plan fits in with the zoning code itself.
So in the early 2000s, there was actually a regional movement in our Metropolitan Planning Organization, which is the Sacramento Area Council of Governments, or SACOG, to create what they called the blueprint. And this has now become a phenomenon, I think, you know, around the country, blueprint planning. But it really started with SACOG in the early 2000s, looking at the long-term effects of business-as-usual planning and development in our region, which was leading to severe air quality problems and traffic congestion, really wasn't creating the outcomes that we needed. And it was also not creating the types of housing that we needed. And so that regional plan set kind of a planning foundation for us to think about, you know, our own city planning in Sacramento. And so our comprehensive plan, the Sacramento General Plan, hadn't really been updated in 20 years. And so it was time to update it anyway. So we had this antiquated local plan and we had brand new gleaming, you know, regional plan with all these big ideas about promoting infill development and transit-oriented development and smart growth and compact development that is going to be, you know, smaller households with people needing one or two bedrooms or even studios. So all of that led us to create a new plan, and that was adopted in 2009. That's called Sacramento 2030 General Plan.
How often does that get updated? Are you still working with the same one?
No, we're not. We set a goal to update it every 5 years.
Oh, that's ambitious.
It is ambitious, and we haven't quite achieved it, but we have updated it twice since then. So it was updated in 2015 and then updated again last year in 2024. So now we're actually working on the 2040 General Plan.
I mentioned earlier that Sacramento has made a number of zoning reforms. Can you give us a little bit of detail about what kinds of things are happening in Sacramento to sort of ease the way for more housing?
In Sacramento, we set out to be a pro-housing, pro-infill, pro-transit community. And so transit-oriented infill housing projects are our number one priority, and we bend over backwards to make them happen. For these projects, we eliminated parking requirements and maximum density limits. We increased height limits and allowable floor area. We reduced setback and open space requirements. We removed conditional use permit requirements for housing developments. And we updated design guidelines to reflect the kinds of projects that our local development industry was trying to deliver. We've also changed the way that we review development projects. In the past, most of those required public hearings before our planning commission, and many, many projects required city council approval. And so it was a very onerous process. And it seems to me that when we set up a system that makes it look like a development project is breaking the rules, which is why it needs all of this scrutiny and approval at such a high level, I think, if not consciously, at least subconsciously, sends a message to the community that they need to show up and oppose it.
Mm-hmm.
And so we've tried to kind of turn that on its head and say, no. Let's do good planning, and then let's set our regulations up to encourage the type of development that we said we wanted in the plan. Now, if we get community support for the plan, then we should have community support for the development that follows the plan. And if that's the case, we should also then be able to delegate approval down to the staff level for most projects, or to a director level hearing process for minor adjustments that are needed. And so that's what we've done. And so now very rarely do development projects go to city council, and not a lot of projects even go to planning commission for development approvals. Those are almost always approved at the staff level.
I think for a lot of planners listening, that's going to blow their minds.
I think it did for us too when we first conceived of it. Like, can we really do this?
It can't have all been easy. It can't have all gone smoothly to move to this way of approving projects. What were some of the challenges?
We did do it in increments. You know, the first thing I mentioned was we did parking reform. And so we decided, you know, we don't need all of this parking that we're requiring. And so we were forcing projects either to ask to waive the parking requirement, or to build incredibly expensive parking garages, or to build parking lots, surface parking lots, which really was not something we wanted in our downtown.
Right.
So we began to realize, wait a minute, we're not helping ourselves out here. So let's cut it back dramatically as far as the amount of parking required initially. And then we actually did a contextual approach. So we realized that the needs in the suburban parts of our city that were more sort of conventionally sprawly, that had been developed in the last few decades, were different from the needs of downtown. And then we had older inner ring neighborhoods between downtown and those suburban areas. So we had different requirements that gradually increased parking needs, you know, as you got further away from the core and further away from transit facilities. Since then, we've just eliminated parking requirements entirely. So the first step was reducing them. Then the next step was eliminating them. For the most part, it's working well. We don't hear a lot of complaints from people. You know, it's not always super convenient. And sometimes you have to park a half a block or a block away, maybe two blocks away. Some people may have to pay for parking, you know, and so these things are evolutions, you know, that have happened over time.
Parking's always a contentious issue, right?
Yep.
And people want to talk about it. But I got the sense from what you were saying before, both in developing the general plan first and the zoning changes building off of that, and then you started to mention the system of reviews, and I got the sense that you had public buy-in for the changes that you were looking to make. And I just wonder if you could touch just a little bit on that public buy-in, but then also getting elected officials on board, or maybe they were driving it.
I think it was a bit of both. And we did have some leaders. You know, our mayors have been supportive. I think for the last three or four mayors we've had have been supportive to varying degrees of, you know, heading in this direction of trying to link the idea of these specific zoning changes that might allow bigger buildings, a greater mix of uses, less parking, some of these types of changes that might feel scary to people, linking those ideas to the bigger picture, which is we as a region need to stop thinking about the idea of building, you know, more freeways and sprawling ever out into the countryside, and really figure out how to revitalize our urban communities that already exist, that are underdeveloped, that are suffering from a lack of investment, and that are already served by bus or light rail transit, in our case here in Sacramento.
You talked earlier about being able to have staff review certain development projects. Can you talk a little bit more about what that looks like and how it works?
What we did, you know, obviously after updating our planning and updating our zoning regulations so that we had rules that reflected the type of development that we wanted to see and the type of development that the community agreed was appropriate, that was going to help us achieve our larger environmental, economic, social goals in our community. Then we, you know, we needed to train our staff to be able to do those reviews. And that wasn't really that difficult. But the real challenge was getting buy-in to the idea that staff could approve different scales of development. So we started out, you know, relatively small, and then we gradually expanded the authority of staff over time as we saw success, as we saw that, you know, the world didn't come to an end because a project got approved by staff and didn't go to the commission. We saw more and more projects going through in a non-controversial way and people accepting the development happening in their areas. Then we allowed taller buildings. Initially, it was only low-rise buildings. Initially, it was only buildings with a certain number of units and that type of thing. And then gradually, we took off those constraints so that now pretty much any project that is consistent with the zoning, it doesn't need any kind of policy change, either at the planning level or at the zoning level, can be approved by staff.
What about when it comes to environmental reviews? I know in California in particular, there's a lot of regulation around that.
There is. And I think it's a big problem, you know, across the state, because environmental impact analysis is something in California that is enforced through litigation. There's no environmental review cops that oversee this process. And so the only way to ensure that it's followed, at least the state has decided the only way that to ensure that it's followed, is by making it easy to sue to enforce it. And so what that means is there's a real fear of litigation. It leads to a very conservative environmental analysis process that creates these enormous multi-volume assessments of environmental impacts and really involve technical studies. And it's very costly and time consuming. A lot of it, again, is probably more than necessary, but is driven by, you know, one time someone got sued in some other place. And so we don't want that to happen to us. So now we're going to make this bulletproof. You know, in Sacramento, we try to take advantage of every exemption from environmental review that there is. A lot of communities are also conservative about that. Don't take advantage of exemptions that are actually allowed by the law. And also, our own former mayor was a state legislator who was the president pro tem of the Senate, and he actually led a streamlining measure that we take advantage of quite a bit for transit-oriented developments that meet certain planning criteria, those can be exempted from environmental review as well. So that allows us to move projects through fairly quickly. And really, I think it's the way it should be. Environmental review should be reserved for projects that are kind of out of the mainstream, that are in a really sensitive area or have the great potential to cause regional impacts that are significant.
I want to get back to housing. I know that in California, every city has targets for housing, how much housing that they're supposed to build. What are the key metrics that you're tracking? And what do the numbers say about your success in meeting your overall housing goals?
In California, we have to track housing by income level. And so that is extremely low income, very low income, moderate income, and above moderate income. Mm. So we track it by income. And basically, the state assumes that apartments are affordable and single-family homes are market rate. I mean, that's a very gross oversimplification. But we obviously look at whether the apartments are subsidized and deed restricted to certain income levels or not. And so market rate apartments used to be affordable to low-income households. Now, I think they tend to be more about the moderate income range. So we're talking about incomes on either side of the median income is the moderate category. And then low income is 80% of the median income. And so we track housing that way, and we look at the different product types that are being built each year. Unfortunately, the challenges for housing, you know, I think nationwide, but particularly in places like California, are so great that despite our best efforts, you know, we aren't meeting our goals. We need to find even more ways to try to get more housing built. Unfortunately, I think we're facing in the last few years, you know, the economic situation with rising interest rates has just made it hard for housing developers to make a profit in a high-cost place like California.
I imagine that that's true. And like you said, it's a problem everywhere, but acute in California. Could you give us a sense, though, of some of the outcomes in terms of housing developed or housing that's in the works that you feel has come about or that your department knows has come about because of the planning and zoning changes that you've made?
During the recession, we had just a really extremely low level of housing development. So I'll say before the recession in 2006, one of our high years, we approved 4,800 housing units in Sacramento. And during the recessionary years, it was down to 265
wow.
or 300 or 400
right.
units. And then by 2015, it started increasing. We had 1,000. In 2016, we had 1,500. 2017, 2,800 units. The last 4 or 5 years, we've been, in the 3,000, 3,700 units a year range. It went down a little bit last year, again, because of the interest rates, I think. And I will say also, just to add to that, the state increased the regional housing targets. And so our share of that regional housing target also has been increased. Previously, it was just looking at population growth, I think, but now they've been factoring in some of the existing deficiency on top of that. And so everybody is struggling to meet the new targets because they're so much higher than they used to be. I think we're supposed to be developing, we should be seeing something like 8,000 units a year being built, or some really high number that is way beyond anything we've seen historically. And it'll be wonderful if we could develop that many housing units. We haven't quite figured out yet what we can do as a municipality to get us there.
Can you give us a sense of how you're doing compared to other places in California in terms of meeting these targets that the state has established?
I think we're in the top handful of cities in the entire state in terms of overall housing numbers, number of units per year. Also, I think we were the leader recently in affordable housing units, deed-restricted affordable housing units. And that's one trend that we've seen in the past 5 or 6 years, more and more affordable housing being built. I want to say I would attribute that, take some credit for the streamlining changes that we've made, because affordable housing had to really run the gauntlet. If you advertise to the public that you want to build an affordable housing project and you take it to a planning commission meeting with a public hearing, I think that sets up a dynamic that can be very negative and make it difficult for projects like that to get approved. It adds more time, more uncertainty, and the potential and the temptation to tinker with the project at a public hearing podium in ways that can make the project less feasible. And so both our streamlining as well as some new state laws that actually make it illegal to do that type of tinkering, to say, look, you can't make people lower the density below what's allowed by the zoning. You can't lower the height limit. You can't condition a project on a project-by-project basis in ways that pares back the project to less than what is otherwise permissible. And so that's really helped, I think, as well in California.
So the streamlining you've put in place has done, you've mentioned two things. It's made it far more predictable for developers and maybe financiers as well. And it's sort of taken out, maybe not entirely, the NIMBY factor.
I think it has. Nothing's hidden. We're transparent. We do post public notice signs on the property when we receive a development application. And so that's put up early in the process so that people can see it for weeks, sometimes a couple months, however long it's going to take for the project to get approved. We post all of our project information on our website. So people who want to find out about development can easily find out what projects are going, and they can see the drawings and the plans, and they can read information about the project on our website. So we have all of that process, but it's different than sending someone, I think, a legal notice that, says, it looks like something's wrong when you get a legal notice mm-hmm. in the mail, I think, and people are suspicious, when they see that. So on the one hand, we're not trying to hide anything that we're doing here. But on the other hand, we're not trying to create that kind of negative anti-development dynamic by the way that we go about the process.
As we wrap this conversation up, which I don't really want to do, Tom, but time is what it is, I want to zoom out to more of a national audience. And as you know, APA and its partner, the National League of Cities, has created the Housing Supply Accelerator Playbook. That playbook focuses on actions all over the country. So it gives planners and others ideas of what they can use in their own communities. I'm wondering what aspects of Sacramento's planning approach and some of the streamlining and zoning reform efforts you've made you see as particularly adaptable to other places.
I'd start with the low-hanging fruit. Focus on updating outdated regulations and regulations that aren't achieving local objectives. Try to help the local leadership understand how the rules that are in place may not be meeting their goals and what could be done to streamline them or to make them right-sized or make them up to date in a way that would help achieve those goals. In Sacramento, we wanted to see our downtown be revitalized and our commercial corridors be revitalized. And we realized that parking regulations and height limits and density restrictions were not getting us there. as well as our cumbersome development review process. And so when we explained that to the community and to our decision makers, they were willing to make adjustments in order to achieve the goals that we had all said we wanted to achieve.
What's next for Sacramento? What you're looking forward to for this coming year? Or what you're most excited about?
In Sacramento, we set out 15 years ago to focus on infill housing along commercial corridors and brownfield and grayfield redevelopment sites. However, our more recent planning has identified the need to further fair housing objectives by providing more affordable housing opportunities in high opportunity neighborhoods. We realize that commercial corridors and redevelopment sites were not adequate to meet this objective, so we needed a way to get more housing in predominantly single-family neighborhoods. So we removed exclusionary single-family density limits citywide, and now we allow duplexes and small apartment buildings in all neighborhoods that were formerly limited to one house per lot.
So we're getting that missing middle housing in there that provides a variety of options within the same neighborhood. That's great to hear. Tom, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast and sharing with us everything that Sacramento has already put in place and really shown its leadership in zoning reform. We really appreciate you sharing that with us.
It's been my pleasure.
And congratulations to the region overall for its recognition of Sacramento County and the $2.7 million Pro Housing Grant. I think that's really, as you said, it really will affect the entire region. People don't look at the city boundary when they're choosing where to live. They look at a place that suits their needs and is affordable.
Exactly.
Tom Pace is the Community Development Director for Sacramento in California. Thanks for listening to another episode of People Behind the Plans, an APA podcast. For more great conversations with experts from across the planning landscape, subscribe to APA Podcasts so you'll never miss an episode. And if you like what you're hearing, please rate us on iTunes. You can find People Behind the Plans on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. You can also find our entire library of episodes at planning.org/podcast.